Puff yourself up. Make yourself big man. First rainstone, now somebody put bad eye on you. You so important, you think somebody care you fall on your arse?
Inchebi made no reply to this, keeping his eyes turned away.
Who wish it on you? Billy demanded. Nobody care that much.
He swung his basket of fish to indicate the world around them, indifferently waking to daylight, taking form from moment to moment in the misty air, the thick-leaved mangroves that seemed to guard the last of the darkness, and the marshes beyond, lying shrouded in mist, the blanched moon above them.
Nobody wish it. Nobody care that much, he said.
Inchebi resumed his way along the path.
Tell you before, he said. Tell you again now. No such thing accident this world. Plant yam bad, get bad crop. Nobody say kudala, say fool man. Plant yam good, get bad crop. That is kudala. Inchebi always riggin trim sharp. Look where he steppin. So, this is kudala. Any dabo can see that.
Jesus save us! That not kudala, that the law of bloody average,
Billy said.
Man pull a boat up 100 times. One time he fall down the bank. Just happen like that.
Just happen like that,
Inchebi repeated scornfully. Annoyance at his fall and badly grazed knuckles and conviction of malpractice against him had combined to sour his temper.
That all you can say? He glanced at Billy with his small bright eyes. Tell me one thing, you so clever. Why it happened this particular morning?
At this, Billy's previously clear view of the matter began to mist over from the edges. It was a strange fact that although they had argued about kudala intermittently over the years, this question of particularity always caught him unprepared.
Why this particular morning?
He repeated now with an instinct of prevarication.
What can question that? Dunno answer that question.
That another thing about you, Billy. Same all buckra white man. You say dare no answer, mean you no have answer. I pull up the boat 100 times, do same thing every time. This one time fall down. Why this time? Why not another time? Boat same, bank same, in Chebby same. Why this time?
Bank wet, Billy said. You put your foot wrong.
Inchebi smiled sadly. He had Billy on the run and knew it.
My friend, he said, you sabi good dat not the right answer. Bank wet many time before. Inchebi foot same other time. I ask you why this time you say foot wrong. I ask you why this time foot wrong you say just happened this time. You go round in circle, Billy. I tell you about one uncle now.
Curse me,
Billy said, stopping short again to glare at his companion.
What the fuck you uncle got to do with it?
This unexpected intrusion of a relative had fogged his mind further.
Middle of the day, uncle sit under roof of the grain store, sit in the shade, you sabi? People do same thing every day. That day, roof fall down, uncle kill. Why that happen?
What kind question that? Maybe pool rot in the ground. Maybe termite stroyed him. Maybe timber worm stroyed a beam.
You think I fool, man? Termite and timber worm? That not the question. Question is, why it happen when my uncle sitting under the roof?
Well, I go tell you this, Billy said after a long pause. I sorry to hear about your uncle, but this story prove nothing.
Nevertheless, he was agitated at his failure to find a convincing reply, at finding himself once more in these thickets of doubt and contradiction. He glanced up at the sky, which shone now with a faint light. Mist lay over the low ground in shifting swathes. The fan-shaped fronds of the palmettos rose here and there clear of it, hanging heavy and gleaming with wet, quite motionless. There was no breath of wind. The swamp willow alongside the path was coming into flower. He noticed the tight green pimples of the buds on their dangling stalks. It was a particularity of vision unusual with Billy, due perhaps to the indistinctness of everything further off in this ubiquitous shrouding of mist. The kudala notion had its points, he suddenly saw. It saved a man from chance, for one thing, and it took the blame from the Almighty, thus solving a problem that had often bothered Billy.
"Do you find the one make kudala again, your uncle?"
he said. But the other did not hear him. The track had narrowed, obliging them to walk in file, and Inchebi had paused to crush some cress leaves over his injured knuckles and so fallen behind. They were nearing the settlement now. The track skirted the lagoon, went some way along the edge of the hardwood hummock, then turned away from the water to pass through a tangle of sea-grape and cabbage palm and wild coffee, before emerging onto the open ground where the first huts of the settlement began. Among the trees it was dark still. Emerging from them was at first confusing to the eyes. As they came out into the scrub, Billy saw form move suddenly in the mist, no more than a dark shape at first, but then as he advanced he saw that it was surmounted with a face and a tall hat. While he still gaped at this, he saw the figure raise its elbows, as if to work a pair of bellows. He caught a gleam of metal, then the dark red of the tunic. He turned and took some running steps back towards Inchebi, who was still in the cover of the trees.
"Redcoats!" he shouted loudly. "Get round through the—"
The crack of the shot came from behind him, drowning out whatever more he said or tried to say. With this sharp report, all arguments were finally resolved for Billy. The frenzy of logic left him forever. The ball took him in the back on the left side and pierced his heart. He ran some further steps, but he was dead before he fell. Inchebi saw Billy turn and run towards him, heard the shot, saw the issue of blood from Billy's mouth and the heavy pitch of his fall. He hesitated no more than a moment. Billy was beyond help. The people had to be warned. He threw down the string of fish he had been carrying and plunged aside from the track in the nearest direction to the settlement, finding what way he could through the close-growing vegetation. He sobbed lightly as he ran, with fear and shock. The broad-leaved trees of the hummock discharged their moisture on him. The saw palmetto slashed at his legs. Legs and arms. He stumbled through stretches of swampland, knee-deep in the sloughs, his feet catching in the stilted roots of the mangroves. Behind him, not very far away, he could hear sounds of pursuit. From moment to moment he expected a shot, but none came, and he could not understand this, having forgotten that alive he was worth money. The cane harpoon impeded him, catching in thickets, but he did not abandon it. Nipke it was who gave pursuit. He had been standing near the panicky fool who disobeyed orders by firing, and had seen the sergeant strike the man down with his fist. He knew that the people of the settlement, whether black or white, had to be taken alive if at all possible, this being the English lord's express command. He knew, too, that time was needed for the troops to complete their encirclement of the huts. Above all, he was eager to earn praise, because with praise came a bonus of dollars, and Nipke looked forward to returning a rich man, rich enough to be drunk for a week and buy another cow and possibly a blanket. So he began running almost before the echoes of the shot had died away, cleared Billy's body as it lay across the path, and was in time to crouch and listen and hear the faint crashing sounds of the black man's flight. Though past his first youth, he was a fine runner, as the Creek people commonly were, and he knew the ground, having ranged here for Tequesta scalps to sell to the English during the wars with Spain. Thoughts of reward sharpened senses already acute. He was alert to every change of direction ahead of him. Following was not difficult. His quarry had no time to rest or hide or lie in wait. He knew by the sounds that he was gaining. There were sounds behind him, too. Other of the Creeks, similarly inspired, had joined in the chase, but he would be the first. He ran through a stand of sea-grape trees, ducking and weaving to avoid the low branches. This was the edge of the hummock. Beyond was an area of marsh grass and willow scrub. He could catch glimpses now of the man before him, hear at times the splash of his steps in the watery ground. He was gaining ground with every stride. The negro was flagging. No more than 20 paces separated them. As he came closer, he drew the hand-axe from his belt, intending to stun the man with a flat side. But he was gaining too fast, it came to him now, with a sudden, belated sense of danger. He saw that the man was carrying a pointed cane, and checked momentarily, then came on with a rush. The negro had left it too late. There was no time now for him to turn and set himself for a throw. This was a serious misjudgment on Nipke's part, and it cost him his life. He had seen many deeds of blood in his time, and he had fought with various weapons at long range and close, but he did not know what a man from the headwaters of the Niger could do with a spear. As they came into the open, Inchebi had slackened speed. He knew that with a light missile, designed for fish, not men, the throat was the only target, and he knew that he only had one chance. When the panting and the steps were close enough behind, he whirled, and, without pausing to set himself or even shift his grip on the shaft, flung the spear upward from waist height, aiming instinctively, the turn and the throw one single movement. The distance was no more than a dozen feet. The barbed head of the spear, with its needle-sharp fishbone point, caught the advancing Indian in the base of the throat and penetrated deeply, half-severing an artery. Nipke dropped the axe and sank to his knees, raising his hands as if in some attempt to arrest the copious flow of blood. Inchebi waited only long enough to be sure that this enemy was disabled. When the others came up, they found Nipke bleeding out his life in the marsh. No sign of the Negro. They resumed the pursuit, but more cautiously. This killing of Nipke, and the greater circumspection it imposed on the other Creek scouts, gave Inchebi a period of respite long enough for a circuitous approach to the settlement from the shoreward side. He made his way under cover of the stockade to the low gate in the rear and crawled under into the compound. The shot had been heard. People were moving here and there. The main gate was barred. Inchebi began to shout the news of Billy's death and his last mysterious words and the presence of flathead Indians not painted or tattooed. His eyes started wildly and he gulped for breath. Distress and exhaustion combined to render his pigeon barely intelligible. "What Billy shout?" Nadri asked, taking a firm grip of Inchebi by the shoulders. He had been with Tabakali and they had come out together at the sound of the shot, she naked to the waist with a piece of cotton cloth wrapped round her middle.
"Say, about Redcott,"
Inchebi panted. He had no idea what these words meant.
"Say, about Redcott, Dandy shoot."
"Holy Mary," Sullivan said. "That's soldiers he talking about, Redcoats. They have sent soldiers after us."
His eyes were wet still with the quick tears that had come with the news of Billy's death.
"It is Redcoats have killed Billy," he said.
To Paris, standing among the others in his beach clout and a shirt strangely patched and shortened, these words of Sullivan's carried immediate conviction. He was shocked, but not surprised. Ever since learning that the fighting was over and the British established in the north, he had been expecting some sort of expedition against them sooner or later. News followed trade. There would have been rumours of merchandise down here more valuable than salt or flint or anything the traders carried.
"We can still get out," he said. "We can't fight men armed with guns, not from inside here. We can break out before they have time to form round us."
"That right."
Kireku's eyes flashed fiercely. He had his bow slung over one shoulder and heavy arrows and a bark quiver at his belt.
"Nobody see Inchebi come," he said. "Nobody try stop him. Dey not in place yet. We can get out same way he come in. In de bush, nobody find us. Redcott, try find me, stick him like pig. Make him cut red past now."
It was to be long remembered of Kireku that even at this desperate moment he had made a joke. He was already moving away when a booming voice reached them from somewhere beyond the stockade.
"You are surrounded on every side. You cannot escape. Lay down your arms and open the gates. We are armed with cannon and can destroy you all at will."
The voice was frightening, unearthly, distorted by an amplifying instrument of some kind, which made it impossible to determine the direction, but the flat accents of northern England were clearly recognisable in it.
"There may be time yet," Paris said. "They may not know of the gate in the rear."
He hesitated, looking at Tabakali and the children standing close beside her, Kenka between the two smaller ones.
"We wait here, catching a trap," he said. "Dey go make you slave again."
He had spoken rapidly and was not sure if she had understood, but she looked at him steadily and after a moment nodded.
"It worth trying," Nadri said. "We get clear, other come behind."
They went at a run through the lines of the huts. Beyond the narrow gate, the space of open ground was deserted. The mist had lifted now, and a pallid radiance showed in the sky above the listless fronds of the palms. Looking upward, Paris saw gulls in lazy flight, the hidden sun eliciting flashes of brilliance from them as they turned. The first trees were less than half a minute away to a running man, but the distance seemed vast to Paris. He saw Kenka regarding him with an intent and painful seriousness, and he reached out and briefly touched the boy's cheek.
"We go 2-3 first time, see what happen," he said.
"Nothing happen, rest all go together. You wait we in de bush, then you start running."
Nadri opened the gate and crouched a moment longer in the shelter of the stockade. His eyes met those of Paris and he smiled. Then he was up and running, with Paris and Kireku close behind. Younger than the others by a good 10 years, and a natural runner, Kireku at once drew ahead. He moved with long strides, head up, the quiver swinging against his thigh. A shout came from somewhere slightly ahead of them, to the right. Kireku was almost in the shadow of the trees now. Then shots rang out in ragged unison, and Paris saw Kireku pitch forward on his face. A moment later, he felt a violent blow to his left leg. He staggered aside and fell heavily and lay on his back, looking up at the sky, feeling nothing at first but the shock of the blow and the fall. Then pain gathered in his leg, and with it a sense of the damage done to him. He knew now that the bone was broken. Raising his head a little, he saw that Kireku was still lying where he had fallen, quite motionless. The trees were no more than 20 yards away. He heard shouts and scattered shots from somewhere on the other side of the compound. Edging round onto his right shoulder, he made an effort to drag himself forward, but it was too soon. Neither his body nor his will was braced enough for the pain, and almost immediately he lost consciousness. When he opened his eyes again, he found himself gazing up at the face of Erasmus Kemp, close above him. He was not conscious of any interval of doubt or any struggle for recognition. He regarded the face silently, noting with a strange sort of dispassion that it was clean-shaven and very pale, and that the dark eyes held a singular brightness and intensity. He felt a certain wonder at the sight, but not really surprise. In a way it seemed natural and even inevitable that his cousin should be here to preside over the last hours of the settlement. The older Kemp had given, though inadvertently, now the younger had come to take away.
"Of course," he said, "you have come to claim your father's cargo."
To Erasmus, this reference to his father seemed the height of unrepentant insolence. Looking down, he saw the lopsided smile he detested appear on his cousin's face.
"I have come to hang you," he said, striving to keep all passion out of his voice.
He took in the details of Paris's appearance, the beard, the sunburn, the long hair tied behind.
"I would not have known you but for that rascally Barton pointing you out," he said with disgust.
His cousin's shirt, and this seemed to Erasmus almost more heinous than anything, reached scarcely to his navel, having been cut off all round, apparently to make patches. The garment he wore below it was little more than a loincloth. His naked, long-shanked legs were outstretched on the ground, the left one a mess of blood below the knee. Erasmus had felt a leap of alarm at first sight of this damage, but the wound, after all, was not serious. The leg could be dressed in St. Augustine.
"Have no fear. You will walk to the gallows," he said.
Paris looked beyond his cousin to the sky, which in this short while seemed to have become much brighter. The gulls still wheeled there, breasts flashing with light as they turned.
"All in one swoop, pretty nearly," Erasmus said in a tone of satisfaction.
He felt the need to drive his triumph home.
"None of the troops got a scratch."
Paris wanted to ask about Kireku and whether any others of the settlement had been hurt, but he saw Erasmus turn at this moment and speak to someone approaching.
"Ah, so you have it ready," Erasmus said. "It has taken you time enough."
Two men came into Paris's field of vision, carrying a blanket slung on poles to make a stretcher. Erasmus looked down again, and his eyes had a light of fever.
"Your turn now to be lifted, Cousin Matthew," he said.
Words not immediately comprehensible to Paris, though for a moment he felt that he was trembling on the verge of understanding. Then the soldiers began to lift him onto the stretcher. His senses swam, and the bright gulls dissolved in the sky above him. Chapter 53. Privileged by his wound, Paris was conveyed as directly as possible to the shore and rowed out to the ship in the late afternoon. Before midnight, both troops and captives had been embarked, and the ship set a course northward for St. Augustine. It was Erasmus's hope that he might avoid the delays of a long sea journey home to England, and the risk of his cousin cheating justice even now by some obscure and private death, by having the people of the crew tried and condemned either at St. Augustine by Campbell, or, if the latter felt this exceeded his competence, by the governor of South Carolina, where the negroes were to be taken and sold. To this end it was important that at least one of the wrongdoers should be persuaded to inform upon his comrades in exchange for a pardon. Erasmus felt that he knew human nature passably well, and did not anticipate any problem here. It would come better from a common seaman, one who had taken an active part. An officer of the ship might be able to claim that he had acted under duress. However, Barton had already proved willing to cooperate, and Erasmus decided to interview him first, so as to establish the facts. The intention once formed, he could not wait for the morning. He had slept little for two nights now, and the emotions of that day had exhausted him, but he could not rest. The ship was barely under way when he had Barton shaken awake, where he lay on the open deck, and brought below. There was rum and salt beef and ship's biscuit laid out on the table, also close to Erasmus's right hand a loaded pistol. A soldier, with bayonet fixed, stood outside the door. Barton sat opposite at the table, and a candle lamp lay between them. The former mate wore nothing but a round cap made of rope yarn, the tattered remains of a red silk scarf, and a pair of deerskin drawers, and he shivered like a dog in the warmer air of the cabin. Erasmus poured him a glass of rum, and he swallowed half of it, hissing on an indrawn breath as the warmth spread through him. He took off his cap and laid it on the table beside him. His lank, gingerish hair fell forward round his face.
"I know who you are," Erasmus said. "You were mate on my father's ship. You've already answered your name today, and so it would serve no purpose to deny it now. I intend to ask you some questions. If you know what is good for you, you will answer me frankly and fully."
Barton raised his head to drink again, draining his glass. The sharp edge of his Adam's apple pricked like a thorn against the loose skin of his throat.
"If you're honest with me now," Erasmus said, "I will speak on your behalf when the time comes."
Whatever calculations Barton engaged in were of short duration.
"I knowed this would happen sooner or later," he said. "I'm a child of misfortune, and no mistake. A man of sorrows, I am, and on nodden terms with grief. That is in the good book, sir. I was brought up for better things than what you see now. I can read and write, if you'll believe me. My sainted mother taught me at her knee. But misfortune has been my lot in this life."
"You will deepen your acquaintance with grief very considerably, my friend," Erasmus said, "if you thus persist in going round and round about things. What befell the ship?"
"What befell her?"
Barton eyed the rum. Cornered as he was, his sense of theatre did not desert him. And he was not altogether destitute, he now perceived. He possessed knowledge the other needed. How strong the need could be seen from the quality of attention he was receiving, the starkness of interest on the handsome face opposite him.
"There is a story in that," he said,
reaching to take some of the meat. But he had paused too long. Erasmus struck the table with a blow that made the glasses rattle.
"God damn your eyes," he said. "You impudent rogue. You stop your cursed play-acting or I will shoot you where you sit." "She didn't go down," Barton said in sudden haste. "She never went down, sir. We was blown off our course by a storm that comes in them parts in late summer, what they call hurricanes, sir. But we never sank. That was a stout ship. She was a gallant ship, and every line of her, I was proud to sail on her." "I will crop your ears yet," Erasmus said between his teeth. "What the devil do I care for your pride? Tell me what happened." "By that time, there wasn't enough healthy men aboard to man her, and we was in fear the blacks would rise on us. We was blown westward here, onto the coast of South Florida. The captain was dead by then. We was unlucky from the start. The trades fell short of us more than usual for the time of year, and we had the bloody flux among the negroes before we cleared the Gulf of Guinea. 'Tis a sea of thunder there, sir, and a breeding ground of plague, with rain and fire coming down by turns. 6 weeks, and we were still southwest of the Cape Verde Islands. and they was dying on us every day. 'Tis a terrible trade. Them not in it will never know the hardships to see your profits dribbling into the sea and nothing you can do. I felt for your father and you, sir. My heart bled. Barton has always been faithful to his owners."
Erasmus poured out more rum. In these close quarters he could smell the sharp reek of sweat, mingled with some fishy odour that came from the other's body, and he tensed his nostrils against it with involuntary repugnance. There was a glaze of the gutter about Barton that no outdoor living had been able to affect. It was there in the abjectness of the manner, which had something insolent in it too, and in the ragged, jaunty finery of the silk scarf. The voice was husky and dry for all the rum, making its claims of constancy and fidelity, seeking to find the right note, enlist favour, strike a course that would bring him in safe from wind and wave. Erasmus set no store by the protestations, but he did not interrupt. Barton appeared to be in the grip of his own story now, staring and eager with it.
"We had to keep them under hatches a lot of the time, increasing the mortality considerable. I tell you, it would have broke your heart to see it. The doctor worked like a slave himself to keep the beggars in the world."
Erasmus looked up sharply at this, and found the mate's eyes fixed on him in a sort of stealthy appraisal, disturbing in one whom he had thought so lost in his narrative.
"What are you looking at?" he said. "Do you mean Paris?"
"Aye, him. Feed him with his own hand, he would. That would be your cousin, I believe, sir, on the matrilineal side."
"What is that to you?"
Erasmus said violently. He was silent for some moments. Then, more calmly, he said,
"He did no more than his duty, I suppose."
"No, sir. Well, on the matrilineal side, so they say, it is not so strong."
No change had occurred in the mate's voice, but there was a certain cautious relaxation in the peering expression of his face and the spread of his elbows on the table. He had found a direction.
"He only done what he was paid to do," he said after a moment.
"We all done that, every man of us. This is excellent quality of rum, sir."
"I don't want to know your opinion of the rum. Here, damn you, have some more. How did Thurso die?"
"There was various wounds, but the cause of death was stabbing."
"Who struck the blow?"
Barton narrowed his eyes, as if in a sustained effort of memory.
"Things was confused," he said. "It's long years ago now, sir, and my remembrance is not clear."
"You'd better endeavour to clear it," Erasmus said. "I shall want to know these things from you."
"I dare say it will all come flooding back to me in the course of time. Anyhow, it was the ship's people that killed Thurso. They rose on him. I spoke out again it. With Barton, duty always comes first. They would have killed me, but they were stopped from it by Mr. Del Blanc. He was a passenger aboard, and by the doctor."
"What part did he play? Mr. Paris, I mean. He was the leader, then. He led the others into this mutiny."
Barton paused. There was no doubt expressed on his face, only a kind of intensified alertness.
"Yes, sir," he said. "He was the leader, without the shadow of a doubt."
"Was he the first to raise his hand against the captain?"
"In a manner of speaking, he was. You see, sir, we had decided to jettison a good part of the cargo. That is, the captain had decided it, and he put it to me and Haines and the carpenter, Barber, the night before. Haines was the boatswain. The second mate was dead by then of a putrid fever, and so we was the only officers left, if you don't count that
jettison them." "You mean throw them overboard?"
Erasmus passed a hand over his brow.
"What, alive, as they stood and fettered?"
"Only them that was sickly, sir. We knowed we could never make Kingston Market with them, and if we did, we could not have sold them. They was too far gone. The worst of the weather was over, but we was blown far westward. Jamaica was a good 10 days off, by the captain's reckoning, even in fair conditions. The water was given out. We was already on half a pint a day. We was wasting water on the negroes, you see, sir, because they was dying anyway. That is not a efficient use of resources. Not only that, but a negro dying of natural causes was a total loss to the owners. That is to your father, sir, begging your pardon, and to you as his son and heir. If they was jettisoned, we could claim the insurance, and that stood at 30% of the value in them days. But you had to show good and sufficient cause."
Erasmus was silent for some considerable time, holding a hand over his eyes as if to shield them from light.
"Shortage of water would constitute sufficient cause," he said at last.
It could be seen as a question of survival. But wait, did you not say that there had been storms of rain? The casks should have been full.
My, Barton exclaimed admiringly. You have got a head on your shoulders, sir, and no mistake.
The main cask was holed. The water leaked away, unbeknown to us.
Yes, I see, Erasmus said slowly.
The cask had suffered damage in the rough weather. A court was likely enough to accept that, he thought, with Barton spruced up to say so, and one more to support him.
I find that Captain Thurso acted lawfully and within his rights, he said. That is how we seen the matter when the captain explained things to us. Haines would tell you the same, but unfortunately he has passed over. He was murdered by savages.
And my cousin intervened, you say? He set himself up against the lawful authority of the captain.
Yes, sir. It was early morning, and Mr. Parris was below with a fever. He must have heard some commotion. We had already sent some of them over the side. He come up and seen what was happening, and he shouted and raised his hand agin it. The captain drew a pistol on him, and that was what started things off.
Thurso went armed, then.
He had taken to it, sir. The men was muttering agin him.
As pretty a piece of arrogant meddling as ever I heard of, Erasmus said, as if to himself.
The more I think about the business, he said more loudly, the more it seems to me that the captain's decision was a sound one, not only in practical terms, but also more humane, shortening the sufferings of these wretches. Them is the sentiments I remember experiencing at the time.
Barton raised his thin face, as if sniffing at the air, and for the merest glimmer of a second, lamplight was confused with sunlight in Erasmus's mind, and he remembered again the day of the accident at the dockside, Thurso and the mate emerging side by side from the shadow of the ship's hull. Barton had spoken to him about the building of the hull, he recollected. He wore the same relishing look now, and Erasmus had the same sense that the mate was trying to form some alliance, some intimacy of understanding between them.
"I'm not interested in your sentiments," he said. "Keep them to yourself. Thurso could hardly have done more for those negroes, short of killing them out of hand."
"He couldn't do that, sir,"
Barton spoke softly, seeming in no way put out by the snub.
"That would be unlawful. The underwriters would never have consented to pay money on negroes killed aboard ship, not unless it was in the course of an uprising, and these was in no case to rise on us."
Erasmus nodded. "As I understand it, the mutineers, led by Mr. Parris, later appropriated what remained of the negroes and carried them ashore. That is correct, isn't it?"
"Yes, sir."
"First mutiny, then murder, then piracy," Erasmus said. "Any one of them a capital offence."
As he spoke, the ship's bell sounded on the deck above them. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. The night was calm, and the vessel sat evenly upon the water, with no sound but the slow, irregular creaking of her timbers.
"They needed the negroes," Barton said. "They couldn't have got the ship in behind the shore without the blacks to help with the towing. She had to be towed from the bank, sir. Every man, woman, and child that could stand on their feet had to bear a hand with the ropes."
"Yes, yes, I know that part of it. In your opinion, was there any intention to return?"
"The vessel was grounded, sir. They hacked through her masts."
"Did they declare they would not return? Did you hear Mr. Parris say that?"
"Yes, sir, I did. Him and Mr. Del Blanc. They talked about setting up a kind of colony in the wilderness where men could live in a state of nature."
"In a state of nature?
What the plague does that mean? Curse me if I know."
With instant responsiveness, Barton's tone had changed to match the amused contempt he saw come to Erasmus's face.
"They talked a lot about freedom and justice," he said. "They was going to found a colony where everybody would be equal and have no use for money." "That den of thieves!"
Erasmus suddenly was smiling. There is a broad division between those who laugh at the perception of incongruities in the world and within themselves, and those in whom laughter is released as a celebration of their own successes, a perception not of incongruity, but of total triumphant correspondence. Erasmus was of this latter sort. Everything had fallen into his hands. He had Parris alive. The guilt was confirmed, the evidence overwhelming. In Barton, he had found an instrument of justice infinitely pliable. And now, To hear of these ridiculous aspirations, it was like crystal sugar on the cake.
By God, that's rich, he said.
And Barton, seeing his new protector's smile deepen, felt something of the delight of one who has found the key to a puzzle he had feared might be too intricate.
I thought I could start afresh, he said, with contemptuous indulgence.
Chapter 54. Through the hours of darkness, Paris lay on the borderlines of fever, where thought and dream and sleeping and waking are confused together. Towards morning, the throbbing of his wound eased for a while, and he entered a phase of clearer recollection. He was back again in the public room of Norwich Jail, with its dark, greasy walls and echoing pavement, and the usual lords of the place, violent criminals all, occupying the coveted area around the fireplace. One of these he remembered in particular, and even his name, Buxton, a man convicted for robbery on the highway, on appeal for his life, a broken-toothed, staring fellow of unpredictable mood. It was Buxton, wearing a towel on his head tied up in knots in imitation of a judge's wig, who had presided at the trial of the young debtor. The mock-serious expression of this unbalanced ruffian was present to Paris's mind as vividly now as if there had been no interval, as was the lost and frightened look of the young man. The two faces had remained in his memory side by side, Buxton and Deva, natural complements one to the other. 2 hours in the pillory had been the sentence of this court. With his head through the legs of a chair and his hands tied to the sides, Deva had stood stock still in full view, head thrust forward tortoise-like below its absurd carapace, too afraid to do more than absorb his shame. I did not intervene, Paris thought. Perhaps I lacked courage. Perhaps I was afraid I might make things worse for him. It was impossible now to be sure. Memory, which still retained clearly enough the impressions of sight, Buxton with his grotesque trappings of justice, the flushed and humiliated face of the young man, did not permit any exact recollection of feeling. Certain it was that he had done nothing. The victim had been released, finally, on the promise of 5 shillings. But what chiefly occupied him now, as the first light strained through the port of his cabin, was not his failure to protest or intervene, but his failure to learn the lesson so conveniently offered. For the men who did this cruel thing had suffered themselves in real courts and had been condemned. I should have known it then, he thought. Nothing a man suffers will prevent him from inflicting suffering on others. Indeed, it will teach him the way. Was it always wrong, then, to believe that the experience of suffering would soften the heart? Those who were fond of declaring that they understood human nature would no doubt conclude so. But as the light strengthened slowly, enabling him to make out the bare furnishings of his cabin, it came to Paris that he did not want to be numbered among these knowing ones, that such understanding was worse than error, worse than hope, endlessly defeated. If that is what it means to be wise, I choose folly, he told himself, and slept again, and woke to daylight and a sweat of pain, and the sight of Sullivan's face above him.
What are you doing here, Michael? He said.
The beautiful, vague eyes of the fiddler sharpened with a sort of triumphant satisfaction.
I told him I was the one looked after you before, he said. I went up to him, and I introduced myself, and inquired if he had seen anything of me fiddle, and he said he had not seen hide nor hair of it, and he was very much afraid I would have to consent to be hanged without it. So I looked him in the eye, and I told him hanging was a matter for the judge, and if I got off, I would want to know what had become of me fiddle. While he was thinking this over, I told him I looked after you before, when you were sick, and he damned my eyes, and gave me permission to do the same now.
That was well done, Paris said, smiling. My cousin wants me looked after so he can the better hang me, though why he has pursued me so I cannot tell. There is not much you can do for me in any case. I applied a tourniquet as soon as I was able, to stop the bleeding, and the sergeant, who knows the business better than a number of surgeons I have met, helped me to set the leg in splints before I was carried aboard. So long as I keep still, I shall be tolerably comfortable.
I thought you might like to have the comfort of washing, Sullivan said. I have brought a bowl of warm water, and I can fetch you victuals from the galley as required. He has given his permission to that.
It was Sullivan's standard medical procedure, which Paris remembered now from the time of his fever.
It is very good of you, Michael, he said. More in order not to disappoint than for any other reason, he felt weak and disinclined to move, he submitted to the bathing of his face and arms and chest.
Sullivan was gentle and deft, and kept up a stream of talk. There had been two deaths among the people of the settlement, in addition to those of Billy and Kareku. Kavanagh had been fatally wounded when he tried to break out with Danka and Tiamoko on the other side of the compound. Nima, seeing him fall, had lost her head and rushed out after the men, and had been killed before she had gone a dozen steps. Her baby, which they had named only the night before, was being suckled by Salian. Nadri had succeeded in reaching the trees, but he had been tracked down and taken by the Creeks.
And Tabakali?
She is there with the rest of them, Sullivan said. Kenka is with her, and the other two children. They're all together on deck under guard of the soldiers. The crew people are kept separate.
Yes, Paris said. We have a separate future now. They cannot sell us, you see, so they will try to hang us as the next best thing.
Cody is there among the others, Sullivan said. She looked at me kindly while I was playing. I should have gone to her straight, but I did not. We are not allowed near them now. After we get to St. Augustine, I'll never see her again in this life.
He paused a moment, and his face brightened a little.
Maybe I will, after all, he said. I have had a good omen.
What was that?
There is a bit of a story to it. When I was first brought aboard the Liverpool Merchant in company with poor Billy, God rest his soul, I was wearing a fine coat with brass buttons down the front. Now, this coat was took from me without so much as a boyer leave, along with every stitch I had on, and I was given slop clothes from the ship's store. That was bad enough for a start, but the worst of it was they never give me back the buttons. Them buttons was never mentioned again. Now, you know the world, Matthew, like myself, and so you will know there is always something that will rouse a man, howsoever patient and long-suffering that man may be.
Thus appealed to, Paris nodded. Yes, he said, sooner or later there will always be something that we cannot overlook or pretend indifference to, something that sticks in the throat.
You have hit me meaning exactly. Them buttons stuck in me throat more than anything else I can call to mind. They were worth money, but it was more than that. A man has his self-respect to think of. I always suspected Haynes of stealing them, and I got proof of it one day when we were ashore cutting stakes. I offered to fight Haynes for them, but Wilson took the quarrel on himself, and so me chance was lost.
Sullivan paused in his task of drying Paris's shoulders and neck, and gave a smile of considerable sweetness.
He would have beat me anyway, he said. The long and short of it is that I never got me buttons back. Then Haynes was killed, and as time went by, they went out of my mind. Then yesterday, as they were driving us through the bush to where the boats were waiting, I tripped over my own feet and fell down the side of a stream, nearly in the water. There I was, lying on me face in the mud, with all the wind gone out of me sails and the corporal cursing at me from the bank. And it was then I seen it, not 6 inches from me eyes. It was crusted over with clay, but I knew it.
He bent down quickly and fumbled a moment at the string of his moccasin. When he straightened up, his face wore its usual serious, slightly melancholy expression. On his right palm, held out to view, a smooth, round metal button, the size of a shilling, gleamed yellow in the flat, shadowless light of the cabin.
"I give it a bit of a polishing," he said. "I couldn't understand how it had come about at first, not for the life of me. Then I bethought myself. That must have been the very spot where Haynes met his end at the hands of the Indians. It must have dropped from him somehow, and the Blessed Virgin tripped up me feet at the very place."
He was still standing there, with the miraculous find shining softly on his palm, when they heard sounds beyond the door. Sullivan brought his hands quickly to his sides. A moment later the door opened, and Erasmus stepped over the threshold.
"You can suspend your ministrations for a while," he said curtly to Sullivan. "I want a few words with Mr. Paris."
"Yes, sir."
Sullivan, however, did not leave quite at once, but turned first to Paris and said, "Will there be anything more I can do for you?"
"No, thank you, nothing."
"In that case," Sullivan said, Take myself off.
Erasmus watched him leave.
There is a brazen fellow, he said. He had the impudence to ask me the whereabouts of his fiddle. That is a gallows bird, if ever I saw one.
If you think that, you cannot ever have seen one. Paris was propped up in his bunk now, and able to get a steady view of his cousin's face, which was white and strained-looking.
"To what do I owe this visit?" he asked. "I must tell you, cousin, it is not welcome to me."
"I do not care if it is welcome or not," Erasmus said. "You have forfeited your rights in such matters."
On this, however, he paused. He was conscious his cousin's question was one that could not be answered altogether frankly. After dismissing Barton in the early hours of the morning, he had slept deeply, his first good sleep for days, but he had woken once again to desolation. There are forms of triumph or fulfilment, and these not always virtuous, that require no witness. They are sufficient in themselves, and can be enjoyed in the quietness of the soul. But the sense of being an instrument of justice was not, it seemed, of this order, not for Erasmus at least. He had felt the need to see it registered on a human face, and there was only one that would do. In all the world there was only Paris that could make the triumph of justice real to him.
"I have been learning something of this settlement of yours," he said at last. "I am told that it was founded on the best philosophical principles."
Paris saw the mockery of this move, the tense lines of his cousin's mouth, and realized that Erasmus had come to bait him. Despite his weakness and the pain of his leg, the old combative urge rose in him, the refusal of intellect or pride to allow another to interpret the world for him, least of all a man who held him captive.
"It sounds as if your informant was Barton," he said. "He is not much acquainted with principles of any kind."
"No, but it is rich, don't you think so?" Erasmus said, "considering that your little colony took its rise from murder and theft?"
He had wished to maintain a tone of levity, but with Paris's first words a rigidness had settled over his features, and his lips tightened as he spoke.
"Murder and theft?"
Paris looked at his cousin with something like wonder.
"You have just stolen these people from their homes, and murdered three of them in the course of it. Their blood is on your head, no matter who fired the shots. Two of them had nothing whatever to do with Thurso's death. In fact, they were some of the stolen goods that you came all this way to recover."
The folly of this took some of the tension from Erasmus's face.
"Your stay in this wilderness has unsettled your brain," he said.
"You must be mad to make such comparisons. Thurso was set in authority over you. He was engaged in a lawful trade. These people are fugitives on the one hand and chattels on the other. I have proceeded at every step with total legality. I have a warrant from the governor of Florida."
"Useful thing, a warrant. Murder and theft change their names if you have one. I suppose the governor himself was armed with one when he took Florida from the crown."
"That is a treasonable speech," Erasmus said. "I have noted it."
"I can only be hanged once," Paris said. "I do not think we will get far along these lines, Erasmus. But I assure you, I had no principles worthy the name. It was Delblanc who was our theorist."
His head felt heavy, and there was a pain gathering behind his eyes. What had Delblanc believed? It was an effort now to think about it. Men are moral beings in their untrammeled nature. If constraint and coercion can once be removed, they will be happy, and if they are happy, they will also be good.
"I did not really share these views," he said, under the momentary impression that he had explained to Erasmus what they were,
"but I knew people are held together by having the sense of a common destiny, and of course I had certain hopes." "What hopes were those?"
The tone was sneering, yet there was an ardour in the question that Erasmus could not conceal. He had been outraged by his cousin's manner. Flushed out from his bolt-hole, wounded and helpless, with his crimes brought home to him, Paris showed no trace of contrition. He spoke as if engaged in some vague and desultory debate. It was monstrous. And yet Erasmus was held, and in some way fascinated, by what the other was saying. He was conscious of effort, of needing continually to make a wider embrace of hatred and contempt, to encompass these movements of his cousin's mind, to let nothing escape. And Paris, too, felt driven, perhaps to disarm or somehow outflank this enmity, which he felt as a pressure almost physical, and which he could not altogether understand. "I knew we had done them harm beyond reckoning," he said. "It was impossible to pretend otherwise. It was impossible not to see that we had taken everything from them, and only for the sake of profit, that sacred hunger, as Delblon once called it, which justifies everything, sanctifies all purposes. You see, I began my career as ship's surgeon in ignorance and carelessness. Because my life was in ruins, I thought it was unimportant what I did, what I assisted in. I thought it could only degrade myself. This was an offence to reason as well as feeling. We have a duty to be vigilant." He fell silent again. The burden of explanation seemed too heavy. Had it not been for the pain of body and weariness of spirit, he might have seen that it was useless in any case. He had sufficient store of irony, and under other circumstances might have realized that he was not the ideal man to offer illumination of any kind. His genius was for error. He had blundered once through confusion between obstinate pride and the disinterested promulgation of truth, and then again, though perhaps it was not much different, through the illusion that his own despair was of cosmic import. Throughout the days of the settlement, he had mistaken his desire to make amends for a belief in the capacities of the human spirit. And now, ragged and feverish captive, he was blundering again, prating of wisdom and virtue to a man determined to believe him wicked, a man to whom virtue meant well-cut clothes, a proud bearing, money in the bank. What, more than anything, he seemed to Erasmus, who had no resources of irony whatever, was an object lesson in how not to conduct one's life. It was only by a persistent operation of the will that Erasmus could maintain belief in his cousin as a scapegoat worthy enough. He glanced at Paris now, saw the deathly pallor below the tan, the small beads of perspiration that had appeared on the brow. How could a vessel so sickly bear so much blame? There was a terrible discrepancy here, and Erasmus flinched from it as from a mortal threat. "It is a lesson strangely hard to learn," he heard Paris say in low tones. "I don't know what you mean," he said coldly. "What lesson? A man with anything about him knows what he wants and tries to get it." This was so obvious that it made him impatient. "That is the way the world goes forward," he said. "Whether in your settlement back there or my larger one on the banks of the Thames, nothing would ever get done otherwise." "Well, that might not be such a bad thing," Paris said rather faintly. "You have not yet told me of your precious hopes." In spite of the weariness that was gaining on him now, Paris heard the malice in this question, and something more, something strangely like appeal. His cousin was desperate for him to admit failure, disappointment, defeated hope. "You want to take everything from me," he said. "I cannot understand why you hate me so. Why should I explain further to you, who only want to hear a bad report? I owe you nothing. If I wronged anyone, it is your father. He showed me kindness and might think I have made a poor return. I hope I may be allowed to speak to him, and given some chance to explain." He had closed his eyes on these last words. He heard a single harsh note of laughter, and opened them again to see something wild and disbelieving on his cousin's face. He saw Erasmus raise a hand briefly to his brow. "What is the matter?" he said.
"You do not know it," Erasmus said. "How could you? I had forgot."
With this, it came from him in a stream there was no stopping. His father's death, and he did not conceal the nature of this now from Paris, the ruin it had brought, the loss of his bride, all the years of paying back the debts, that these years had brought him also wealth and power he did not mention. The fact was evident enough in any case, and he could think only of his wrongs, only of his cousin's monstrous guilt. And because of this, all caution departed him, all the lessons he had learned in a hard school, that you must keep your object firmly in mind and rigorously exclude all that might be prejudicial to it, that you must always hold something back, keep something in reserve, because that is the way to retain control. All this, in the treacherous fluency that swept him, was forgotten. He found himself talking to this hated cousin, whom he had pursued and crippled, and intended more firmly than ever to see hanged, as he could have talked to no one else, with a fervent intimacy that in some part of his mind astonished him still as he spoke, with revelations of feeling long buried within him, the deceit of his father's silence and its wounding lack of trust, the bitterness of his mother's superior wit in their dealings with the doctor, old Walpert's patronizing treatment of him, and Sarah's inability to see the true meaning of his renunciation.
"She accused me of wanting to add her to my store of possessions," he said.
He had never forgotten the words.
"I was forced to go into sugar when I wanted to build canals. I married against my inclination for the sake of the alliance."
Sarah was long since married. He knew it from his Liverpool acquaintance. She had married a local squire, and there were children now. All this he sought to lay at his cousin's door. But to Paris, listening, with face averted, it seemed that Erasmus was not accusing, but confessing. He was begging to be released.
"Nothing that becomes of me can mend these things," he said. "You will still be where you were."
He saw that Erasmus had drawn himself up into a position of rigid attention in the course of speaking, as if braced for some ordeal. The pathos of his cousin's singleness of vision came to him, the terrible emptiness of conquest.
"Can you not see that?" he said gently.
Erasmus heard the change of tone. Detected amidst the lines of weariness and pain on his cousin's face, traces of an insolent compassion. All his life he had hated to see knowledge of him on any face. After a moment more, he turned and walked out of the cabin. Outside the door, at the foot of the ladder, he stood for a short while as if uncertain of his direction. Tears had risen in his eyes, a rare thing with him. Of all the injuries that Paris had done him, it seemed to him for a moment that this kindness of tone was the worst. Chapter 55. Early in the morning of the following day, Paris awoke to pains in the lower region of the chest, on the left side. They lessened after a while, but were followed shortly by a feeling of constriction in the lungs, forcing him to take shallow breaths, as any deeper inhalation brought renewed pain. As he lay thus, it seemed to him that he could hear an occasional rattle of chains from the deck above. But he was feverish, and there was a singing in his ears, and so he thought it might have been an illusion. Sullivan, arriving with the morning gruel, heard the quick breaths as he entered, and saw that Paris's face was terribly changed. He could not eat, and would not submit to be washed.
"Will you listen to that now?"
Sullivan said, in a voice disguised by scolding.
"What can I do for you, then?"
"You can stay beside me here."
Paris saw the other man turn his head aside sharply.
"It is all right," he said. "It is only that I don't want to be moved."
"No one will move you," Sullivan said.
Paris lay without speaking for a while, then said,
"I thought I heard the sound of fetters up on deck. I must have been mistaken. There are soldiers enough for a guard."
"No, it was no mistake.
During the night, two of the soldiers took a hold of Dinka and started dragging her off, and Safadu tried to prevent them, and one felled him with the barrel of his musket. Then Hambo, who was standing alongside, struck this one with his fist, putting thoughts of ravishment out of the fellow's mind for a good time to come. Then Callie got excited, you know how he is sometimes, and he caught hold of a lad standing near him and set off to strangle him with the strap of his own hat. But that they are forbid to shoot without the order, Hambo and Callie would be dead. As it is, them and Safadu are in irons for the rest of the voyage, Safadu with a split head and all."
"So," Paris said, "the wheel has come round in a full circle.
They will all be in irons once the troops have been disembarked."
The pain came again, somewhere just below the breastbone, and he closed his eyes, waiting for it to subside.
"We are back where we began," he said.
"No, we are not,"
Sullivan said.
"That is not a thought to be having in your mind now. You can never come back to where you start. You're a travelled man, Matthew, like myself, and as a travelled man you must know things never join up again once you have gone to any distance. How can they, seeing as there is a gap of time between? There is 12 years between this craft we're on now and the Liverpool Merchant. Even if them years were not everything you wanted them to be, you can't say they never happened. Billy is dead, but he still had them years of hopping about and arguing the toss, which is what he liked doing most of all. I keep thinking of Coody, and that last night when we named the baby. She looked at me. She was impressed with me playing, and I'm not surprised. I played like a demon that night. There was power in me. Now, I know I missed